important of him, with only three royals left. If Oak was the High King, then Matic could be the regent. He would rule over Faerie until Oak came of age. And then, who knew what might happen? If he could keep Oak in check, he might rule over Faerie forever. I was just a child once, too, I tell her. I don't think Matic was enormously concerned about what I could handle then. And I don't think he will be too worried about Oak now. It's not like I don't think he loves Oak. Of course he loves him. He loves me, too. He loved my mother. But he is what he is. He cannot be other than his nature. Oriana grabs my hand, squeezing it tightly enough that her nails sink into my skin. You don't understand. Child kings do not survive long, and Oak is a frail boy. He was too little when he was brought into this world. No king or queen from any court will bow their heads to him. He wasn't raised for this burden. You must stop it. What might Matic do with so much power unchecked? What might I do with a brother on the throne? And I could put him there. I have the winning card to play, because while Baelkin would resist crowning Oak, I bet Cardin wouldn't. I could make my brother the High King and myself a princess. All that power is right there for the taking. All I have to do is reach out my hand. The odd thing about ambition is this. You can acquire it like a fever, but it is not so easy to shed. Once, I was content to hope for knighthood and the power to force Cardin and his friends to leave me alone. All I wanted was to find some place to fit in here in Faerie. Now, I wonder what it would be like to choose the next king. I think of the tide of blood running over the stone dais to drip down onto the packed earthen floor of the hill, running over the bottom edge of the crown so that when Baelkin had lifted it, his hands had been smeared red. I imagine that crown on Oak's brow and flinch from the image. I remember, too, what it had felt like to be glamored by Oak. Over and over. I slapped myself until my cheek was red and hot and sore. A bruise bloomed the next morning. A bruise that didn't fade for a week. That's what children do with power. What makes you think I can stop it? I demand. Oriana doesn't release my hand. You once said that I was wrong about you, that you would never hurt Oak. Tell me, can you do anything? Is there a chance? I'm not a monster, I told her, back when I said I would never hurt Oak. But maybe being a monster was my calling. Maybe, I tell her, which is no answer at all. On my way out, I spot my little brother. He is out in the garden, picking a bouquet of foxgloves. He's laughing, sunlight turning his brown hair gold. When his nurse comes toward him, he darts away from her. I bet he doesn't even know that those flowers are poison. Chapter 25. Laughter greets me when I return to the Court of Shadows. I'm expecting to find Cardin as I left him, cowed and quiet, perhaps even more miserable than before. Instead, his hands have been untied, and he is at the table, playing cards with the roach, the ghost, and the bomb. At the center are a pile of jewels and a jug of wine. Two empty bottles rest beneath the table, green glass catching the candlelight.
Jude, the bomb calls happily. Sit down. We'll deal you in.
I am relieved to see her, here and unscathed. But nothing else about this tableau is any good. Cardin grins at me as though we've been great friends all our lives. I forgot how charming he can be. And how dangerous that is. What are you doing? I burst out. He's supposed to be tied up. He's our prisoner.
Worry not, Where is he going to go?
The roach asks.
You really think he can get past all three of us? I don't mind being one-handed,
Cardin interjects.
But if you're going to restrain both of my hands, then you'll have to pour the wine directly into my mouth.
He told us where the old king kept the really good bottles, says the bomb, pushing back her white hair. Not to mention a stash of jewelry that belonged to Elowen. He figured that in the confusion, no one would notice if it got lifted. And so far, no one has. Easiest job the roach has ever done. I want to scream. They weren't supposed to like him, but why wouldn't they? He's a prince who's treating them with respect. He's Dane's brother. He's folk, like them.
Everything is spiraling into chaos anyway,
says Cardin.
Might as well have some fun. Don't you think, Jude?
I take a deep breath. If he undermines my position here, if he manages to make me an outsider, then I am never going to get the Court of Shadows to go along with the plan that is still jumbled up in my head. I can't seem to figure out how to help anyone. The last thing I need is him making everything worse. What did he offer you? I ask. Like we're all in on the same joke. Yes, it's a gamble. Maybe Cardin didn't offer them anything at all. I try not to seem like I'm holding my breath. I try not to show how small Cardin makes me feel. The ghost gives me one of his rare smiles.
Mostly gold, but also power, position.
A lot of things he hasn't got, said the bomb.
I thought we were friends,
Cardin says half-heartedly. I'm going to take him in back, I say, putting my hand on the top of the chair in a proprietary fashion. I need to get him out of the room before he gets the better of me in front of them. I need to get him away now.
And do what? Asks the roach.
He's my prisoner, I remind them, squatting down and slicing through the strips of my dress, still tying his legs to the chair. I realize he must have slept this way, sitting upright, if he slept at all. But he doesn't look tired. He smiles down at me. As if the reason I'm on my knees is because I am curtsying. I want to wipe that smile off his face, but maybe I can't. Maybe he'll go on smiling that way to his grave.
Can't we stay out here?
Cardin asks me.
There's wine out here.
That makes the roach snicker.
Something bothering you, princeling? You and Jew don't get along after all.
Cardin's expression shifts into something that appears to resemble worry. Good. I lead him into Dane's office, which I guess I've just commandeered for my own. He walks unsteadily, his legs stiff from being bound. Also possibly because he has helped my crew down several bottles of wine. No one stops me from taking him, though. I close the door and turn the lock. Sit down, I tell him, pointing to a chair. He does. I walk around, settling myself on the other side of the desk. It occurs to me that if I kill him, I can finally stop thinking about him. If I kill him, I won't have to feel like this anymore. Without him, there's no clear path to putting Oak on the throne. I'd have to trust that Madoc had some way of forcing Baelkin into crowning him. Without him, I have no cards to play. No plan. No helping my brother. No nothing. Maybe it would be worth it. The crossbow is where I left it, in the drawer of Dane's desk. I draw it out, cock it back, and point it at Cardin. He draws a ragged breath.
You're going to shoot me?
He blinks.
Right now?
My finger caresses the trigger. I feel calm. Gloriously calm. This is weakness, to put fear above ambition, above family, above love. But it feels good. It feels like being powerful.
I can see why you'd want to,
he says, as though reading my face and coming to some decision.
But I really prefer if you didn't.
Then you shouldn't have smirked at me constantly. You think I'm going to stand being mocked here, now? You still so sure you're better than me? My voice shakes a little, and I hate him even more for it. I have trained every day to be dangerous, and he is entirely in my power. Yet I'm the one who is afraid. Fearing him is a habit I could break with a bolt to his heart. He holds up his hands in protest, long bare fingers splayed. I am the one with the royal ring.
I'm nervous,
he says.
I smile a lot when I'm nervous. I can't help it.
That is not at all what I expected him to say. I lower the crossbow momentarily. He keeps talking, as though he doesn't want to leave me too much time to think.
You are terrifying. Nearly my whole family is dead, and while they never had much love for me, I don't want to join them. I've spent all night worrying what you're going to do, and I know exactly what I deserve. I have a reason to be nervous.
He's talking to me as though we're friends instead of enemies. It works, too. I relax a little. When I realize that, I am nearly freaked out enough to shoot him outright.
I'll tell you whatever you want,
he says.
Anything.
No word games? The temptation is enormous. Everything Taryn told me is still rattling around in my head, reminding me how little I know. He puts a hand over where his heart should be.
I swear it.
And if I shoot you anyway?
You might well,
he says, wry.
But I want your word that you won't.
My word isn't worth much, I remind him.
So you keep saying.
He raises his brows.
It's not comforting, I've got to tell you.
I give a surprised laugh. The crossbow wavers in my hand. Cardin's gaze is locked on it. With deliberate slowness, I set it down on the wood of the desk. You tell me whatever I want to know. All of it. And I won't shoot you.
And what can I do to persuade you not to turn me over to Baelkin and Madoc?
He lifts a single eyebrow. I am not used to the force of his attention being on me like this. My heart speeds. All I can do is glower in return. How about you concentrate on staying alive? He shrugs.
What do you want to know?
I found a piece of paper with my name on it, I say. Over and over. Just my name. He flinches a little, but doesn't say anything. Well, I prompt.
That's not a question.
He groans, as though exasperated.
Ask me a proper question, and I'll give you an answer.
You're terrible at this whole telling me whatever I want to know thing. My hand goes to the crossbow, but I don't pick it up. He sighs.
Just ask me something. Ask about my tail. Don't you want to see it?
He raises his brows. I have seen his tail, but I am not going to give him the satisfaction of telling him that. You want me to ask you something? Fine. When did Taryn start whatever it is she has with Locke? He laughs with delight. This appears to be a discussion he isn't interested in avoiding. Typical.
Oh, I wondered when you would ask about that. It was some months ago. He told us all about it, throwing stones at her window, leaving her notes to meet him in the woods, wooing her by moonlight. He swore us to silence, made it all seem like a lark. I think, in the beginning, he did it to make Nikasia jealous. But later...
How did he know it was her room? I ask, frowning. That makes his smile grow.
Maybe he didn't. Maybe either of you would have done as his first mortal conquest. I believe his goal is to have both of you in the end.
I don't like any of this. What about you? He gives me a quick, odd look.
Locke hasn't gotten around to seducing me yet, if that's what you're asking. I suppose I should be insulted.
That's not what I mean. You and Nikasia were... I don't know what to call them. Together isn't quite the word for an evil and beautiful team, ruining people and enjoying it.
Yes. Locke stole her from me,
Cardin says with a tightness in his jaw. He doesn't smile, doesn't smirk. Clearly it costs him something to tell me this.
And I don't know if Locke wanted her to make some other lover jealous, or to make me angry, or just because of Nikasia's magnificence. Nor do I know what fault in me made her choose him. Now do you believe I am giving you the answers you were promised?
The thought of Cardin being broken-hearted is almost beyond my imagining. I nod. Did you love her?
What kind of question is that?
He demands. I shrug. I want to know.
Yes,
he says, his gaze on the desk, on my hand resting there. I am suddenly conscious of my fingernails, bitten to the quick.
I loved her.
Why do you want me dead? I ask. Because I want to remind us both that answering embarrassing questions is the least of what he deserves. We're enemies, no matter how many jokes he tells or how friendly he seems. Charmers are charming, but that's all they are. He lets out a long breath and puts his head down on his hands, not paying nearly enough attention to the crossbow.
You mean with the Nixies? You were the one who was thrashing around and throwing things at them. They're extremely lazy creatures, but I thought you might actually annoy them into taking a bite out of you. I may be rotten, but my one virtue is that I'm not a killer. I wanted to frighten you, but I never wanted you dead. I never wanted anyone dead.
I think of the river and how, when one Nixie detached from the others, Cardin waited until it paused and then left, so we could get out of the water. I stare at him, at the traces of silver on his face from the party, at the inky black of his eyes. I suddenly remember how he pulled Valerian off me when I was choking on fairy fruit. I never wanted anyone dead. Against my will, I recall the way he held that sword in the study with Baelkin and the sloppiness of his technique. I thought he'd been doing that deliberately to annoy his brother. Now, for the first time, I consider the possibility that he just doesn't much like sword fighting. That he'd never learned it particularly well. That if we ever fought, I would win. I consider all the things I have done to become a worthy adversary of him. But maybe I haven't been fighting Cardin at all. Maybe I've been fighting my own shadow. Valerian tried to murder me outright. Twice. First in the tower, then in my room, at my house. Cardin lifts his head, and his whole posture stiffens as though some uncomfortable truth just came home to him.
I thought when you said you killed him, you meant that you tracked him down, and...
His voice trails off, and he starts over.
Only a fool would break into the general's house.
I draw down the collar of my shirt so he can see where Valerian tried to strangle me. I have another on my shoulder from where he knocked me into the floor. Believe me yet? He reaches toward me, as though he's going to run his fingers over the bruises. I bring up the crossbow, and he thinks better of it.
Valerian liked pain, he says. Anyone's. Mine, even. I knew he wanted to hurt you.
He pauses, seeming to actually have heard his own words.
And he had. I thought he'd be satisfied with that.
It never occurred to me to wonder what it was like to be Valerian's friend. It sounds like it wasn't so different from being his enemy. So it doesn't matter that Valerian wanted to hurt me, I ask? So long as he wasn't going to kill me.
You have to admit, being alive is better.
Cardin returns, that faintly amused tone back in his voice. I put both of my hands on the desk. Just tell me why you hate me, once and for all. His long fingers smooth over the wood of Dane's desk.
You really want honesty?
I am the one with the crossbow, not shooting you because you promised me answers. What do you think?
Very well.
He fixes me with a spiteful look.
I hate you. Because your father loves you, even though you're a human brat born to his unfaithful wife. While mine never cared for me, though I am a prince, a fairy. I hate you because you don't have a brother who beats you. And I hate you because Locke used you and your sister to make Nikasia cry after he stole her from me. Besides which, after the tournament, Baelkin never failed to throw you in my face as the mortal who could best me.
I didn't think Baelkin even knew who I was. We stare at each other across the desk. Lounging in the chair, Cardan looks every bit the wicked prince. I wonder if he expects to be shot. Is that all? I demand. Because it's ridiculous. You can't be jealous of me. You don't have to live at the sufferance of the same person who murdered your parents. You don't have to stay angry, because if you don't, there's a bottomless well of fear ready to open up under you. I stop speaking abruptly, surprised at myself. I said I wasn't going to be charmed, but I let him trick me into opening up to him. As I think that, Cardin's smile turns into a more familiar sneer.
Oh, really? I don't know about being angry. I don't know about being afraid. You're not the one bargaining for your life.
That's really why you hate me, I demand. Only that? There's no better reason? For a moment, I think he's ignoring me. But then I realize he's not answering because he can't lie. And he doesn't want to tell me the truth. Well, I say, lifting the crossbow again, glad to have a reason to reassert my position as the person in charge. Tell me. He leans in and closes his eyes.
Most of all, I hate you because I think of you. Often. It's disgusting and I can't stop.
I am shocked into silence.
Maybe you should shoot me after all,
he says, covering his face with one long fingered hand. You're playing me, I say. I don't believe him. I won't fall for some silly trick, because he thinks I am some fool to lose my head over beauty. If I was, I couldn't last a single day in Faerie. I stand, ready to call his bluff. Crossbows aren't great at close range, so I trade mine for a dagger. He doesn't look up as I walk around the desk to him. I place the tip of the blade against the bottom of his chin, as I did the day before in the hall, and I tilt his face toward mine. He shifts his gaze with obvious reluctance. The horror and the shame on his face look entirely too real. Suddenly, I am not so sure what to believe. I lean toward him, close enough for a kiss. His eyes widen. The look in his face is some commingling of panic and desire. It is a heady feeling, having power over someone. Over Cardan, who I never thought had any feelings at all. You really do want me, I say, close enough to feel the warmth of his breath as it hitches. And you hate it. I change the angle of my knife, turning it so it's against his neck. He doesn't look nearly as alarmed by that as I might expect. Not nearly as alarmed as when I bring my mouth to his. Chapter 26. I don't have a lot of experience with kisses. There was Locke, and before him, no one. But kissing Locke never felt the way that kissing Cardan does. Like taking a dare to run over knives. Like an adrenaline strike of lightning. Like the moment when you've swum too far out in the sea and there is no going back. Only cold black water closing over your head. Cardan's cruel mouth is surprisingly soft. And for a long moment after our lips touch, he's still as a statue. His eyes close, lashes brushing my cheek.
I shudder, as you're supposed to when someone walks over your grave. Then his hands come up, gentle as they glide over my arms. If I didn't know better, I'd say his touch was reverent. But I do know better. His hands are moving slowly because he is trying to stop himself. He doesn't want this. He doesn't want to want this. He tastes like sour wine. I can feel the moment he gives in and gives up, pulling me to him despite the threat of the knife. He kisses me hard, with a kind of devouring desperation, fingers digging into my hair. Our mouths slide together, teeth over lips over tongues. Desire hits me like a kick to the stomach. It's like fighting, except what we're fighting for is to crawl inside each other's skin. That's the moment when terror seizes me. What kind of insane revenge is there in exulting in his revulsion? And worse, far worse, I like this. I like everything about kissing him. The familiar buzz of fear, the knowledge I am punishing him, the proof he wants me. The knife in my hand is useless. I throw it at the desk, barely registering as the point sinks into the wood. He pulls back from me at the sound, startled. His mouth is pink, his eyes dark. He sees the knife and barks out a startled laugh, which is enough to make me stagger back. I want to mock him, to show up his weakness without revealing mine, but I don't trust my face not to show too much. "Is that what you imagined?" I ask, and I'm relieved to find that my voice sounds harsh.
"No,"
he says tonelessly.
"Tell me," I say.
He shakes his head, somewhere chagrined.
"Unless you're really going to stab me, I think I won't. And I might not tell you even if you were going to stab me."
I get up on Dane's desk to put some distance between us. My skin feels too tight, and the room seems suddenly too small. He almost made me laugh there.
"I'm going to make a proposal," Cardin says. "I don't want to put the crown on Baelkin's head just to lose mine. Ask whatever you want for yourself, for the Court of Shadows, but ask something for me. Get him to give me lands far from here. Tell him I will be gloriously irresponsible far from his side. He never needs to think of me again. He can sire some brat to be his heir and pass the high crown to it. Or perhaps it will slit his throat, a new family tradition. I care not."
I am grudgingly impressed that he's managed to come up with a fairly decent bargain, despite having been tied to a chair for most of the night, and probably quite drunk. "Get up," I tell him.
"So you're not worried I'm going to run for it?"
he asks, stretching out his legs. His pointy boots gleam in the room, and I wonder if I should confiscate them since they're potential weapons. Then I remember how bad he is with a sword. "After our kiss, I am such a fool over you, I can hardly contain myself," I tell him with as much sarcasm as I can muster. "All I want to do is nice things to make you happy. Sure, I'll make whatever bargain you want, so long as you kiss me again. Go ahead and run. I definitely won't shoot you in the back." He blinks a few times.
"Hearing you lie outright is a bit disconcerting."
"Then let me tell you the truth. You're not going to run because you've got nowhere to go." I head to the door, flip the lock, and look out. The bomb is lying on a cot in the sleeping room. The roach raises his eyebrows at me. The ghost is passed out in a chair, but he shakes himself awake when we come in. I feel flushed all over and hope I don't look it.
"You done interrogating the princeling?"
the roach asks. I nod. I think I know what I've got to do. The ghost takes a long look at him.
"So, are we selling? Buying? Cleaning his guts off the ceiling?"
"I'm going to take a walk," I say, to get some air. The roach sighs. I just need to put my thoughts in order, I say, and then I will explain everything.
Will you?
The ghost wants to know, fixing me with a look. I wonder if he guesses how easily promises are coming to my lips. I'm spending them like enchanted gold, doomed to turn back into dried leaves and tills all over town. I talked with Matic, and he offered me whatever I wanted in exchange for Cardin. Gold, magic, glory, anything. The first part of this bargain is struck, and I haven't even admitted I know where the lost prince might be. The ghost's lip curls at the mention of Matic, but he's silent.
So what's the holdup?
Asks the roach.
I like all those things.
I'm just working out the details, I say. And you need to tell me what you want. Exactly what you want. How much gold? What else? Write it down. The roach grunts but doesn't seem inclined to contradict me. He signals with one clawed hand for Cardin to return to the table. The prince staggers, pushing off the wall to get there. I make sure all the sharp things are where I left them, and then I head for the door. When I look back, I see Cardin's hands are deftly splitting the deck of cards, but his glittering black eyes are on me. I walk to the Lake of Masks and sit on one of the black rocks over the water. The setting sun has lit the sky on fire, set the tops of the trees ablaze. For a long time, I just sit there, watching the waves lap at the shoreline. I take deep breaths, waiting for my mind to settle, for my head to clear. Overhead, I hear the trilling of birds calling to one another as they roost for the night, and see glowing lights kindle in hollow knotholes as sprites come awake. Baelkin cannot become the High King, not if there's anything I can do about it. He loves cruelty and hates mortals. He would be a terrible ruler. For now, there are rules dictating our interactions with the human world. Those rules could change. What if bargains were no longer needed to steal mortals away? What if anyone could be taken at any time? It used to be like that. It still is in some places. The High King could make both worlds far worse than they are, could favor the unseelie courts, could sow discord and terror for 1,000 years. So, instead, what if I turn Cardin over to Matic? He would put Oak on the throne and then rule as a tyrannical and brutal regent. He would make war on the courts that resisted swearing to the throne. He would raise Oak in enough bloodshed that he would turn into someone like Matic, or perhaps someone more secretly cruel, like Dane. He would be better than Baelkin, and he would make a fair bargain with me and with the Court of Shadows, if only for my sake. And I, what would I do? I could go with Vivi, I suppose. Or I could bargain to be a knight. I could stay and help protect Oak, help insulate him from Maddox's influence. Of course, I would have little power to do that. What would happen if I cut Matic out of the picture? That would mean no gold for the Court of Shadows, no bargains with anyone. It would mean getting the crown somehow and putting it on Oak's head. And then what? Matic would still become regent. I couldn't stop him. Oak would still listen to him. Oak would still become his puppet. Still be in danger. Unless somehow Oak could be crowned and spirited away from Faerie. Be the High King in exile. Once Oak was grown and ready, he could return, aided by the power of the Greenbriar crown. Matic might still be able to assert some authority over Faerie until Oak got back. But he wouldn't be able to make Oak as bloodthirsty, as inclined toward war. He wouldn't have the absolute authority that he'd have as a regent with the High King beside him. And since Oak would have been reared in the human world, when he came back to Faerie, hopefully he'd be at least somewhat sympathetic to the place where he was raised and the people he met there. 10 years. If we could keep Oak out of Faerie for 10 years, he could grow into the person he's going to be. Of course, by then, he might have to fight to get his throne back. Someone. Probably Matic. Possibly Baelkin. Maybe even one of the minor kings or queens could squat there like a spider, consolidating power. I squint at the black water. If only there were a way to keep the throne unoccupied for long enough that Oak becomes his own person, without Matic making war, without any regent at all. I stand up, having made my decision. For good or ill, I know what I'm going to do. I have a plan. Matic would not approve of this strategy. It's not the kind he likes, where there are multiple ways to win. It's the kind where there's only one way. And it's kind of a long shot. As I stand, I catch my own reflection in the water. I look again and realize that it can't be me. The Lake of Masks never shows you your own face. I creep closer. The full moon is bright in the sky. Bright enough to show me my mother looking back at me. She's younger than I remember her. And she's laughing, calling over someone I cannot see. Through time, she points at me. When she speaks, I can read her lips. Look! A human girl. She appears delighted. Then Maddox's reflection joins hers, his hand going around her waist. He looks no younger then, but there is an openness in his face that I have never seen. He waves to me. I am a stranger to them. Run, I want to shout. But, of course, that's the one thing I don't need to tell her to do. The bomb looks up when I enter. She's sitting at the wooden table, measuring out a grayish powder. Beside her are several spun glass globes, corked shut. Her magnificent white hair is tied up with what looks like a piece of dirty string. A smear of grime streaks over her nose. The rest of them are in the back, she says, with the princeling, getting some sleep. I sit down at the table with a sigh. I'd been tensed up to explain myself, and now all that energy has nowhere to go. Is there anything around to eat? She gives me a quick grin as she fills another globe and sets it gingerly in a basket by her feet. The ghost picked up some black bread and butter. We ate the sausages, and the wine's gone, but there might still be some cheese. I rummage through the cupboard, take out the food, and then eat it mechanically. I pour myself a cup of bracing and bitter fennel tea. It makes me feel a little steadier. I watch her make explosives for a while. As she works, she whistles a little off-key. It's odd to hear. Most of the folk are musically gifted, but I like her tune better for being imperfect. It seems happier, easier, less haunting. Where will you go when all this is done? I ask her. She glances over at me, puzzled. What makes you think I'm going anywhere? I frown at my nearly empty cup of tea. Because Dane's gone. I mean, isn't that what the ghost and the roach are going to do? Aren't you going with them? The bomb shrugs her narrow shoulders and points a bare toe at the basket of globes. See all these? I nod. They don't travel well, she says. I'm going to stay here, with you. You've got a plan, right? I am too flummoxed to know what to say. I open my mouth and begin to stammer. She laughs. Cardin said that you did. That if you were just making a trade, you would have done it already. And if you were going to betray us, you'd have done that by now, too. But, I say, and then lose my train of thought. Something about how he wasn't supposed to be paying that much attention. What did the others think? She goes back to filling globes. They didn't say, but none of us likes Baelkin. If you've got a plan, well, good for you. But if you want us on your side, maybe you could be a little less cagey about it. I take a deep breath and decide that if I am really going to do this, I could use some help. What do you think about stealing a crown right in front of the kings and queens of fairy? Her grin curls up at the corners. Just tell me when I get to blow up. 20 minutes later, I light the stub of a candle and make my way to the room with the cots. As the bomb said, Cardin is stretched out on one, looking sickeningly handsome. He's washed his face and taken off his jacket, which he has folded up under his head for a pillow. I poke him in the arm, and he comes awake instantly, raising his hand as though to ward me off. Shh, I whisper. Don't wake the others. I need to talk to you.
Go away. You told me you wouldn't kill me if I answered your questions, and I did.
He doesn't sound like the boy who kissed me, sick with desire just hours ago. He sounds sleepy, arrogant, and annoyed. I am going to offer you something better than your life, I say. Now, come on. He stands, shouldering on his jacket, and then follows me into Dane's office. Once we're there, he leans against the door jamb. His eyes are heavy-lidded, his hair messy from the bed. Just looking at him makes me feel hot with shame.
You're sure you brought me here just to talk?
It turns out that having kissed someone, the possibility of kissing hangs over everything. No matter how terrible an idea it was the first time, the memory of his mouth on mine shimmers in the air between us. I brought you here to make a deal with you. His eyebrow goes up.
Intriguing.
What if you didn't have to go hide somewhere in the countryside? What if there were an alternative to Baelkin's being on the throne? That's clearly not what he was expecting me to say. For a moment, his insouciant swagger fails him.
There is,
he says slowly.
Me. Except I would be a terrible king, and I would hate it. Besides, Baelkin is unlikely to put the crown on my head. He and I have never gotten on particularly well.
I thought you lived in his house. I cross my arms over my chest protectively, trying to push away the image of Baelkin punishing Cardin. I can't have any sympathy now. He tips his head back, looking at me through dark lashes.
Maybe living together is the reason we don't get on.
I don't like you either, I remind him.
So you've said.
He gives me a lazy grin.
So if it's not me, and it's not Baelkin, then who?
My brother Oak, I tell him. I'm not going to go into how, but he's of the right bloodline. Your bloodline. He can wear the crown. Cardin frowns.
You're sure?
I nod. I don't like telling him this before I ask him to do what I need, but there's little he can do with the knowledge. I will never trade him to Baelkin. There is no one to tell but Matic, and he already knows.
So Matic will be regent,
Cardin says. I shake my head. That's why I need your help. I want you to crown Oak the High King. And then I'm going to send him to the mortal world. Let him have a chance to be a kid. Let him have a chance at being a good king someday.
Oak might make different choices than the ones you want him to,
Cardin says.
He might, for instance, prefer Matic to you.
I have been a stolen child, I tell him. I grew up in a foreign land for a far lonelier and worse reason than this. Vivi will care for him. And if you agree to my plan, I'll get you everything you asked for and more. But I need something from you. An oath. I want you to swear yourself into my service. He barks out the same surprised laugh he made when I threw my knife at the desk.
You want me to put myself in your power? Voluntarily?
You don't think I'm serious, but I am. I couldn't be more serious. Inside my crossed arms, I pinch my own skin to prevent any twitches, any tells. I need to seem completely composed, completely confident. My heart is speeding. I feel the way I did when I was a child, playing chess with Matic. I would see the winning moves ahead of me, forget to be cautious, and then be brought up short by a move of his I hadn't predicted. I remind myself to breathe, to concentrate.
Our interests align,
he says.
What do you need my oath for?
I take a deep breath. I need to be sure you won't betray me. You're too dangerous with the crown in your hands. What if you put it on your brother's head after all? What if you want it for yourself? He seems to think that over.
I'll tell you exactly what I want. The estates where I live. I want them given to me with everything and everyone in them. Hollow Hall. I want it.
I nod. Done.
I want every last bottle in the royal cellars, no matter how old or rare.
They will be yours, I say.
I want the roach to teach me how to steal, he says.
Surprised, I don't answer for a moment. Is he joking? He doesn't seem to be. Why? I ask finally.
It could come in useful,
he says.
Besides, I like him.
Fine, I say incredulously. I will find a way to work it out.
You really think you can promise all that?
He gives me a considering look. I can. I do. And I promise we will thwart Baelkin. We will get the crown of Faerie, I tell him heedlessly. How many promises can I make before I find myself accountable for them? A few more, I hope. Cardan throws himself into Dane's chair. From behind the desk, he gazes at me coolly from that position of authority. Something in my gut twists, but I ignore it. I can do this. I can do this. I hold my breath.
You can have my service for a year and a day,
he says. That's not long enough, I insist. I can't, he snorts.
I am sure that your brother will be crowned and gone by then. Or we will have lost, despite your promises, and it won't matter anyway. You won't get a better offer from me, especially not if you threaten me again.
It buys me time, at least. I let out my breath. Fine. We're agreed. Cardan crosses the room toward me, and I have no idea what he's going to do. If he kisses me, I'm afraid I will be consumed by the hungry and humiliating urgency that I felt the first time. But when he kneels down in front of me, I am too surprised to formulate any thoughts at all. He takes my hand in his, long fingers cool as they curl around mine.
Very well,
he says impatiently, not sounding in the least like a vassal about to swear to his lady.
Jude Duarte, daughter of Clay. I swear myself into your service. I will act as your hand. I will act as your shield. I will act in accordance with your will. Let it be so for 1 year and 1 day, and not for a minute more.
You've really improved the vow, I say, although my voice comes out strained. Even as he said the words, I felt like somehow he got the upper hand. Somehow, he's the one in control. He stands in one fluid motion, letting go of me.
Now what?
Go back to bed, I tell him. I'll wake you in a little while and explain what we've got to do.
As you command,
Cardan says, mocking smile pulling at his mouth. Then he goes back to the room with the cots, presumably to flop down on one. I think about all the strangeness of his being here, sleeping in homespun sheets, wearing the same clothes for days on end, eating bread and cheese and not complaining about any of it. It almost seems like he prefers a nest of spies and assassins to the splendor of his own bed. Chapter 27. The monarchs of the Seelie and Unseelie courts, along with the wild, unallied fairies who came for the coronation, had made camp on the easternmost corner of the island. They had pitched tents, some in motley, some in diaphanous silks. When I get close, I can see fires burning. Honey wine and spoiled meat perfume the air. Cardin stands next to me, dressed in flat black. His dark hair combed away from a face scrubbed clean. He looks pale and tired, although I let him sleep as long as I dared. I didn't wake up the ghost or the roach after Cardin swore his oath. Instead, I talked strategy with the bomb for the better part of an hour. She is the one who got me the change of clothes for Cardin, the one who agreed he might come in useful. Which is how I came to be here, about to try to find a monarch willing to back a ruler other than Baelkin. If my plan is going to succeed, I need someone at that feast who is on the side of a new king. Preferably someone with the power to keep a dinner party from devolving into another slaughter if things go sideways. If nothing else, I'll need lots of disruptions to be sure I can get Oak out of there. The bomb's glass globes aren't going to be enough. What I'll have to offer in exchange, I am not entirely sure. I've spent all my own promises. Now I will begin spending the crowns. I take a deep breath. Once I stand in front of the lords and ladies of Faerie and declare my intent to go against Baelkin, there's no going back, no crawling under the coverlets in my bed, no running away. If I do this, I am bound to Faerie until Oak sits on the throne. We have tonight and half of tomorrow before the feast, before I must go to Hollow Hall, before my plans either come together or come entirely apart. There's only one way to keep Faerie ready for Oak. I have to stay. I have to use what I've learned from Matic and the Court of Shadows to manipulate and murder my way into keeping the throne ready for him. I said 10 years, but perhaps 7 will be enough. That's not so long. 7 years of drinking poison, of never sleeping, of living on high alert. 7 more years. And then maybe Faerie will be a safer, better land. And I will have earned my place in it. The Great Game, Locke had called it, when he accused me of playing it. I wasn't then, but I am now. And maybe I learned something from Locke. He made me into a story. And now I am going to make a story out of someone else.
So I am to sit here and feed you information,
Cardin says, leaning against a hickory tree.
And you're going to charm royalty? That seems entirely backward.
I fix him with a look.
I can be charming. I charmed you, didn't I?
He rolls his eyes.
Do not expect others to share my depraved tastes.
I am going to command you, I tell him.
Okay?
A muscle jumps in his jaw. I am sure it is no small thing for a prince of Faerie to accept being controlled, especially by me. But he nods. I speak the words. I command you to stay here and wait until I am ready to leave this forest. There is imminent danger, or a full day has passed. While you wait, I command you to make no sound or signal to draw any others to you. If there is imminent danger, or a day has passed without my return, I command you to return to the Court of Shadows, concealing yourself as well as you are able until you are there.
That is not too poorly done,
he tells me, managing to retain his haughty, regal air somehow. It's annoying. Okay, I say. Tell me what you can about Queen Annet. What I know is this. She left the coronation ceremony before any of the other lords or ladies. That means she hates either the idea of Baelkin or the idea of any high monarch. I just have to figure out which.
The Court of Moths is sprawling and very traditionally Unseelie. She's practical-minded and direct. and she values raw power over other things. I also heard she eats her lovers when she tires of them.
He raises his eyebrows. Despite myself, I smile. It's bizarre to be in this with Cardin, of all people. And weirder still for him to talk with me this way, as he might to Nikasia or Locke. So why did she walk out of the coronation? I ask. It sounds like she and Baelkin would be perfect for each other.
She has no heirs, he said, and despairs of ever bearing one. I think she would not have liked to see the wasteful slaughter of an entire line. Moreover, I don't think she would be impressed that Baelkin killed them all and still left the dais without a crown.
Okay, I say, sucking in a breath. He grabs hold of my wrist. I am shocked by the sensation of his skin warm against mine.
Take care,
he says, and then smiles.
It would be very dull to have to sit here for an entire day just because you went and got yourself killed.
My last thoughts would be of your boredom, I tell him, and head off toward Queen Annette's unseelie encampment. No fires burn, and the tents are of a rough greenish fabric, the color of swamp. The sentries out in front are a troll and a goblin. The troll is wearing armor painted over in some dark color that seems too close to dried blood for comfort. Hello, I say, which I realize I need to work on. I'm a messenger. I need to see the queen. The troll peers down at me, obviously surprised to find a human before him.
And who dares send a delicious messenger to our court?
I think he might actually be flattering me, although it's hard to tell. The High King Baelkin, I lie. I figure using his name is the fastest way to get in. That makes him smile, although not in a friendly way.
What is a king without a crown? That's a riddle, but one to which we all know the answer. No king at all.
The other sentry laughs.
We will not let you pass, little morsel. Run back to your master and tell him that Queen Annette does not recognize him, though she appreciates his sense of spectacle. She will not dine with him no matter how many times he asks or what delectable bribes he sends along with his messages.
This isn't what you think, I say.
Very well. Tarry with us a while. I bet your bones would crunch sweetly.
The troll is all sharp teeth and mild threat. I know he doesn't mean it. If he meant it, he would have said something else entirely and just gobbled me up. Still, I back off. There are guest obligations on everyone who came for the coronation, but guest obligations among the folk are baroque enough that I am never sure if they protect me or not. Prince Cardin is waiting for me in the clearing, lying on his back, as though he's been counting stars. He looks a question at me, and I shake my head before I slump down in the grass. I didn't even get to talk to her, I say. He turns toward me, the moonlight highlighting the planes of his face, the sharpness of his cheekbones, and the points of his ears.
Then you did something wrong.
I want to snap at him, but he's right. I messed up. I need to be more formal, more sure that it is my right to be allowed in front of a monarch, as though I am used to it. I practiced everything I would say to her, but not how I would get to her. That part seemed easy. Now I can see that it won't be. I lie back beside him and look up at the stars. If I had time, I could make a chart and trace my luck in them. Fine. If you were me, whom would you apply to?
Lord Roybin and the Elder King's son, Severin.
His face is close to mine. I frown at him. But they're not part of the High Court. They haven't sworn to the crown.
Exactly,
Cardin says, reaching out a finger to trace the shape of my ear. The curve, I realize. I shudder, eyes closing against the hot spike of shame. He keeps talking, but he seems to realize what he's been doing and snatches his hand away. Now we're both ashamed.
They have less to lose, and more to gain, throwing in with a plan that some might call treason. Severin reportedly favors a mortal knight and has a mortal lover, so he'll speak with you. And his father was an exile, so recognition of his court itself would be something. As for Lord Roybin, the stories make him seem like some figure in a tragedy. A Seely knight, tortured for decades as a servant in the Unseely court he came to rule. I don't know what you offer someone like that, but he has a big enough court that if you got him to back Oak, even Balekin would be nervous. Other than that, I know he has a consort he favors, though she is of low rank. Try not to annoy her.
I remember Cardin drunkenly talking us past the guards on the way out of the coronation. He knows these people, knows their customs. No matter how high-handed he sounds giving advice, or how much he bothers me, I would be a fool not to listen. I push myself to my feet, hoping there aren't hectic spots of red coloring my cheeks. Cardin sits up too, looking as though he's about to speak.
I know, I say, starting toward the camp. Don't bore you by dying.
I decide to try my luck with the Alder King's son, Severin, first. His camp is small, as is his domain. A stretch of woods just outside Roybin's court of termites, and neither Seely nor Unseely in nature. His tent is made of some heavy cloth, painted in silver and green. A few knights sit nearby around a cheerful fire. None of them are in armor. Just heavy leather tunics and boots. One is fussing with a contraption to suspend a kettle over the fire and boil water. The human boy I saw with Severin at the coronation, the redhead who caught me staring, is talking with one of the knights in a low voice. A moment later, they both laugh. No one pays me any notice. I march up to the fire. "Your pardon," I say, wondering if even that is too polite for a royal messenger. Still, I have no choice but to barrel on. I have a message for the Alder King's son. The new High King wishes to come to an arrangement with him.
Oh, really?
The human surprises me by speaking first.
Yes, mortal, I say, like the hypocrite I am.
But come on, that's absolutely how one of Balekin's servants would talk to him. He rolls his eyes and says something to one of the other knights as he stands. It takes me a moment to realize I am looking at Lord Severin. Hair the color of autumn leaves, and moss-green eyes, and horns curving from behind his brow to just above his ears. I am surprised at the thought of his sitting with the rest of his retinue before a fire, but I recover quickly enough to remember to bow. I must speak with you alone, I say.
Oh?
He queries. I do not respond, and his brows rise.
Of course, he says.
This way.
You should fix her,
the human boy calls after us.
Seriously, glamored human servants are creepy.
Severin doesn't answer him. I trail behind him into the tent. None of the others follow, although, when we get inside, there are some women in gowns sitting on cushions, and a piper playing a little tune. A female knight sits beside them, her sword across her lap. The blade is beautiful enough to catch my eye. Severin leads me to a low table surrounded by tufted stools and piled with refreshments. A silver carafe of water with a horn handle, a platter of grapes and apricots, and a dish of little honeyed pastries. He gestures for me to sit, and when I do, he settles himself on another stool.
"Eat whatever you wish,"
he says, making it seem like an offer rather than a command. "I want to ask you to witness a coronation ceremony," I say, ignoring the food. "But Balekin's not the one who's going to be crowned." He doesn't look immensely surprised, just slightly more suspicious.
"So you're not his messenger?"
"I am the next High King's messenger," I say, taking Cardin's ring from my pocket as proof that I have some connection to the royal family, that I am not just making up this story from whole cloth. Balekin isn't going to be the next High King.
"I see."
His effect is impassive, but his gaze is drawn to the ring.
and I can promise you that your court will be recognized as sovereign if you help us. No threat of conquest from the new High King. Instead, we offer you an alliance. Fear crawls up my throat, and I almost can't say the words. If he won't help me, there's some chance he'll betray me to Baelkin. If that happens, things get a lot more difficult. I can control a lot, but I cannot control this. Severin's face is unreadable.
I am not going to insult you by asking whom you represent. There is only one possibility. The young Prince Cardin, of whom I hear many things. But I am not the ideal candidate to help you, for the very reasons your offer is so tempting. My court is afforded little consequence. And more, I am the son of a traitor, so my honor is unlikely to be given weight.
You're going to Baelkin's banquet already. All I need from you is aid at the critical moment. He's tempted. He admitted as much. Maybe he just needs some more convincing. Whatever you've heard about Prince Cardin, he will make a better king than his brother. At least there I am not lying. Severin glances toward the edge of the tent, as though wondering who can overhear me.
I will help you, so long as I am not the only one. I say this as much for your sake as for mine.
With that, he stands.
I wish you and the prince well. If you need me, I will do what I can.
I get up off the stool and bow again. You are most generous. As I leave his camp, my mind whirls. On one hand, I did it. I managed to speak with one of the rulers of Faerie without making a fool of myself. I even kind of persuaded him to go along with my plan. But I still need another monarch, a more influential one, to agree. There is one place I have been avoiding. The largest camp belongs to Roibin of the Court of Termites. Notoriously bloodthirsty, he won both of his crowns in battle. So he has no reason to object to Baelkin's blood-soaked coup. Still, Roibin seems to feel much the way Annet of the Court of Moths does. That Baelkin is of little consequence without a crown. Maybe he won't want to see one of Baelkin's messengers either. And, given the size of his encampment, I can't even imagine the number of guardians I would have to pass in order to speak with him. But possibly, I could sneak in. After all, with so many of the folk around, what is one person, more or less? I gather up a bundle of fallen branches, large enough to be a respectable contribution to a fire, and walk toward the termite camp with my head down. There are knights posted around the perimeter, but, indeed, they pay me little mind as I walk past. I feel giddy with the success of my plan. When I was a child, sometimes Madoc would have to stop in the middle of a game of nine men's Morris. The board would remain as it was, waiting for us to resume. All through the day and the night, I would imagine my moves and his countermoves until, when we sat down, we were no longer playing the original game. Most often, what I failed to do was accurately anticipate his next moves. I had a great strategy for me, but not for the game I was in. That's how I feel now, walking into the camp. I am playing a game opposite Madoc, and while I can spin out plans and schemes, if I can't accurately guess his, I am sunk. I drop the kindling beside a fire. A blue-skinned woman with black teeth regards me for a moment, and then goes back to her conversation with a goat-footed man. Dusting the bark from my clothes, I walk toward the largest tent. I keep my step light, and my stride easy and even. When I find a patch of shadow, I use it to crawl under the edge of the cloth. For a moment, I lie there, half hidden on both sides and completely hidden on neither. The inside of the main tent is lit with lanterns burning with green alchemical fire, tinting everything a sickly color. In every other way, however, the interior is lush. Carpets are layered, one over another. There are heavy wooden tables, chairs, and a bed piled with furs,
and brocade coverlet stitched with pomegranates. But on the table, to my surprise, are paper cartons of food. The green-skinned pixie who was with Reuben at the coronation uses chopsticks to bring noodles to her mouth. He sits beside her, carefully breaking apart a fortune cookie.
"What does it say?"
the girl asks.
"How about the trip you told your girlfriend would be fun ended in bloodshed as usual?"
"It says, your shoes will make you happy today,"
he tells her, voice dry, and passes the little slip across the table for her verification. She glances down at his leather boots. He shrugs, a small smile touching his lips. Then I'm dragged roughly out from my hiding place. I roll onto my back outside the tent to find a knight standing above me, her sword drawn. There is no one to blame but myself. I should have kept moving, should have found a way to hide myself inside the tent. I should not have stopped to listen to a conversation, no matter how surprising I found it.
"Get up,"
the knight says. Dulcamera. Her face shows no recognition of me, however. I stand, and she marches me into the tent, kicking me in the legs once we get there so I topple onto the rugs. I have cause to be thankful for their plushness. For a moment, I let myself lie there. She presses her boot against the small of my back, as though I am some felled prey.
"I caught a spy,"
she announces.
"Shall I snap its neck?"
I could roll over and grab her ankle. That would throw her off balance for long enough that I could get up. If I twisted her leg and ran, I might be able to get away. At worst, I'd be on my feet, able to grab a weapon and fight her. But I came here to have an audience with Lord Reuben, and now I have one. I stay still and let Dulcamera underestimate me. Lord Reuben has come around from the table and bends over me, white hair falling around his face. Silver eyes regard me pitilessly.
"And whose court are you a part of?"
"The High King's," I say. "The true High King, Eldred, who was felled by his son."
"I am not sure I believe you."
He surprises me both with the mildness of the statement and with the assumption that I am lying.
"Come sit with us and eat. I would hear more of your tale. Dulcamera, you may leave us."
"You're going to feed it?" she asks sulkily. He does not answer her, and after a moment of stony silence, she seems to remember herself. With a bow, she leaves. I go to the table. The pixie regards me with her ink-drop black eyes like tatterfells. I notice the extra joint in her fingers as she reaches for an egg roll.
"Go ahead," she says. "There's plenty. I used most of the hot mustard packets, though."
Reuben waits, watching me. "Mortal food," I say, in what I hope is a neutral way.
"We live alongside mortals, do we not?"
he asks me.
"I think she more than lives beside them,"
the pixie objects, looking at me.
"Your pardon,"
he says, and waits. I realize they really expect me to eat something. I spear a dumpling with a single chopstick and stuff it into my mouth.
"It's good."
The pixie resumes eating noodles. Reuben gestures to her.
"This is Kay. I imagine you know who I am, since you snuck into my camp. What name might you go by?"
I'm unused to such scrupulous politeness being afforded to me. He's doing me the courtesy of not asking for my true name. "Jude," I say, because names have no power over mortals. "And I came to see you because I can put someone other than Baelkin on the throne. But I need your help to do it."
"Someone better than Baelkin? Or just someone?"
he asks. I frown, not sure how to answer that. "Someone who didn't murder most of his family on stage. Isn't that automatically better?" The pixie, Kay, snorts. Lord Reuben looks down at his hand, on the wooden table, then back at me. I cannot read his grim face.
Vailkin is no diplomat, but perhaps he can learn. He's obviously ambitious, and he pulled off a brutal coup. Not everyone has the stomach for that.
I almost didn't have the stomach to watch it,
Kay says. He only sort of pulled it off, I remind them. And I didn't think you liked him very much, given what you said at the coronation. A corner of Reuben's mouth turns up. It is a gesture in miniature, barely noticeable.
I don't. I think he's a coward to kill his sisters and father in what appeared to be a fit of pique. And he hid behind his military, letting his general finish off the High King's chosen heir. That bespeaks weakness, the kind that will inevitably be exploited.
A cold chill of premonition shivers up my back.